When I was in large corporate America, when especially in Washington, D.C., with, say, Georgetown, or New York City with NYU and Columbia, Philadelphia with Penn, it was natural that you would say, in the business side, we're going to do blank, we're thinking about this, let's see what's going on there. Let's go over to Wharton and see if they're doing this, if they're going to want to do this with us. And I think Jacksonville, to its great credit, is getting smarter and smarter on the role that schools like ours can play.
That was Tim Kost, president of Jacksonville University. Tim is our guest for episode 11 of Innovate Jax, the podcast where we hear the stories of the creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs who will help elevate Jacksonville as a leading southeastern city of innovation. I'm your host, Kate Warnock. Now, on to the interview. All right, President Kost, I am so excited to have you join us on the Innovate Jax podcast. You're going to be kicking off our 2020 year, and I can't imagine a better person to start the year with than yourself. So I want to start, first of all, you are the president of Jacksonville University, but you're also its first alum as president, so that's a really special role. First, maybe just introduce the school to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about Jacksonville University.
Sure. Kate, thanks for having us. I think it's fun here as we're in a new decade to be talking about innovation. I think Jacksonville's got an awful lot going for it. Let me give you a quick bullet on the university. Been around since 1934. It started with a smaller focus on the classic liberal arts, especially the social sciences and humanities. What it's grown to be today, we're really very proud of. I mean, it's a powerful economic engine, both in Arlington as well as Jacksonville and beyond. It's a school of about 4,300 students, both undergrads and grads. We have four colleges, we have five schools, we have two institutes. I think if people think about the role of the modern university, which is partly to prepare students to go out and do their next thing, partly to challenge them to become lifelong learners and interested, and partly to serve the community. We believe we serve. And so when you think about a university like ours now, the stuff we're probably best known for is a really explosive role in healthcare in the entire country. So we have extraordinary nursing and orthodontics program, and we've built a terrific school of applied health sciences, first metaphorically and then physically a school. So everything from speech pathology and kinesiology to mental health counseling and occupational therapy and data analytics and healthcare informatics. And because we're looking to match the region, Jacksonville, Florida being a great healthcare region, we now believe we're the premier healthcare educator in that area. The business school, the Davis College of Business, tremendously well thought of. So you have the Brooks College, Brooks Rehabilitation College of Healthcare Sciences. You have the Davis College of Business. So in that area, think about the training of all the business executives, young men and women in the region, the southeastern U.S., finance, accounting, statistics, economics, sport management, the fine arts. We have the Linda Barry Stein College of Fine Arts, which we've been doing since 1961. So that is the world of the performing arts, as well as design and technology. And I'm sure we'll talk about kind of the modern world of TED really comes to life over there. We're very pleased. And then the college that had historically been the biggest and is now kind of the engine of a lot of the classic liberal arts and sciences university, that's the College of Arts and Sciences. So you have the traditional social sciences and humanities, which is how schools like us began. And then you've got the emerging world of the STEAM, so the science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, and we really believe in that. And so you see us doing everything in there from artificial intelligence to robotics to cybersecurity to our engineering work. And next year, and we'll talk about it, we'll have it done in 2020, so it'll be this year now, we're going to open what we believe will be the first physical location where we co-locate all of the STEAM functions, the STEAM disciplines in one physical space on the main quad. So we're working on that right now. It's exciting. So Jacksonville University, we attract students from essentially all 50 states and about 50 foreign countries. They do very well here. It's exciting. And you're right, I'm an alum. I came here to play baseball years and years ago. It's nice to be back.
You know, President Kost, I just heard there was a recent report talking about colleges are really having to compete now for students because the actual volume, the potential volume of students has dropped. You know, I guess the population statistics, fewer children are in this upcoming generation. So what is it that really draws? Is there a primary draw to JU, or how do you compete on the stage when there are so many other schools for students to consider?
Yeah, there's some really interesting demographics. If you take a look at if you were an actuarial, you'd be looking at it going back to coming out of World War II, going into this year, 2020, you look at the kind of the arc of how many children are being born in this country. You go out 18 years, classically, and you figure they're going to be, quote, college age. The data you're referencing actually continues to look. I sit on the board of the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank, so we're looking at all these data. It continues to go up and to the right, new births in this country, at about 1.8%, right up into the years 25 and 26, especially. And beginning in 2026, it's exactly what you described. You actually, for the first time in almost 50 years, see a pretty dramatic fall off in the millions of babies per year. Drop off, and you say, what could have happened? You always try to find data and then peel it apart. And in this case, you look back in time, and coming out of the 2008 recession, while we may not have known it about our neighbors, we were all agreeing to do one thing, and that's not have children. And so from 2008 to 2026, come to 2026, only 6 years from now, if you're in the university world, you realize the number of 18-year-olds in America is going to be substantially less and will be that way for several years into the future. So now your question comes to life. The idea that schools like ours, when we compete in the state of Florida alone, there are 30 private universities, what they call independent, and then there are 12 state universities. So of those 42 universities, people tend to think about the five premier or preeminent privates. Everybody knows the big public schools like Florida and Florida State and others. But among the privates, you've really got from north to south, you go Jacksonville, Stetson, Rollins, Tampa, Miami. Those five universities are natural, if you want to use the word, competitors. If you think about who we really compete with as you go up the Eastern Seaboard, we frequently get, you know, students who were considering an Elon or a Wake Forest or a Furman. Pretty standard that, you know, students, if you go into the world of athletics, however, when a student has a chance to come here and play lacrosse or baseball or basketball, now you're talking about, you know, they were trying to decide between, you know, Colgate and Vanderbilt in here, that sort of thing. So you do need to, you were starting to ask, I think, about differentiation. What can the university provide that makes it a unique experience for this young person? So if you think about a university like ours, which essentially has 3,000, the term is TUG, traditional undergraduates, that come in each year, and another roughly 1,300 graduate students across everything from master's in business administration to doctorates in nursing. That idea about how do you make yourself relevant in the lifestyle they're currently leading? How is it you use technology? We have some really interesting technology plays here. We're unashamed to talk about the weather here. I mean, it's a very big push for a university like ours. Very unlike a lot of the universities, sort of the state university system tends to draw in any state, the Pennsylvania State University, the Ohio State, the Florida University system tends to draw state students. When you look at our niche and sort of our reach, the Mid-Atlantic, the Northeast, and the Midwest, those students come down here in large numbers and do very well. The idea that you're a university in 2020 that's got a tuition that begins with a 3, when you're up north of the Mason-Dixon line, all the schools begin in the 60,000, 70,000 plus. And when you add into that the cost of room and board, et cetera, it's a $100,000 a year undertaking. So we've absolutely carved for ourselves a spot where the student sits at the center of everything that we do. The students are in my office regularly. We're where they're eating. We're talking to them about what it is that's going to enable them to learn well, rather than put more money into, you know, study spaces in the basement of a library when it's 18 degrees out in New York. We are building outdoor study spaces. So you can come here now, and I think students, you can pretty much tell when we're in mid-flight, when it's a January, February, or in October and the weather's nice, they're all out there studying, you know, brand new places for them to have their fitness, different offerings in food, extremely secure campus, virtually redone every living space on this university campus, which is different than a lot of universities believe they have enough market power and you want to be at their school, that you're going to live wherever we tell you to live. Our feeling was that the living arrangements they had, whether they were kind of classic first year dormitory style residence hall, or whether they were apartment style, or whether they were suite style, we've upgraded all of that recently, including, you know, the residence halls I lived in the 70s, which we've just made multi-million dollar investments in, which is pretty exciting. And so to keep that communication loop open between them and us, the students and their families and the administration and the faculty, has been very exciting, because they can make observations. Students are very good at making observations of the current state. it's unfair to say to them, so then, would you like us to do this or this or this? Or they have no idea how much those things cost or how difficult they are or whether there's regulations around them. So we've begun to incorporate, kind of bake in to our long-term planning, strategic planning, capital planning, resource planning, personnel planning, technology planning, things we can see coming. And there are incredible books being written on the subject of how these young people want to learn today and where they're going to go. And then we've made a huge push to wrap up on how well do we do in helping them get where they want to go next. And so you've got a graduation rates that are rising here. At the same time, you've got job placement rates that are above 90%. So the economy remains exciting, you know, in various parts of the country. People are coming to Florida, so that's helped us to recruit students. We're also having a very good time keeping them in Florida. So that's a quick 30 seconds.
And you managed to get through all of that without saying that you're also waterfront.
We are blessed for those who have, I would love to have them come over. What I noticed when I came here in the 70s, I just never seen such a beautiful piece of land. I mean, you got to give the folks credit in the 40s and 50s for that. We inherited that. We have taken that responsibility seriously. And right now we've invested more than $50 million over the last couple of years in this beautiful 250-acre waterfront, St. John's River. I mean, when you want to come here and study, if we want to talk individual programs, something like the marine sciences, I always say to people who want to study the marine sciences, you can walk out of a building and be hip deep in the marine science immediately in the water, or you can go out on a vehicle, you can go out into the water on a research vessel that's a floating laboratory, 30 students. And when, you know, states like Florida were worried about things like flesh-eating bacteria and was it real or was it not, you know, they looked to us and we went out on the water and we did the work. And so we're able to develop areas like the marine science with agreements like OSearch that take you from just studying the St. John's River and the floating of plastic, and then you go out to the ocean and coral reefs, and then you follow the movements and the whole lifestyle and ecosystem of the apex predator that's the great white shark, and you learn, and then you research and you publish. And we have a role both on the economic side of this town, but also I think there has to be an intellectual component where you can come and you can be an honest broker of difficult discussions. You can have a civil discourse. 2020 is going to be, as we're all into it now, an unbelievable year in the national discourse of policy and politics. We have a role there. So, yes, thank you for reminding me we're on the water.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. All right. Yeah. All right, President Cost, you've referenced a couple times now that you were here as a student yourself. Yeah. I wonder, how does being an alum guide you now as president?
I think one of the things, not that many, you know, I spent 32 years in corporate America. My education at this university really prepared me incredibly well to come out. My first year out of college was Ronald Reagan's first year in the White House, and that 1981 to 88 window of what was going on in America and the explosion of what was happening in the economies. And I think the sense that the country and all those of us who were young executives were kind of getting our footing really well. So I was able to move through, you know, great corporations, Kodak and PepsiCo and Bristol Myers and others. Never really had contemplated, other than serving on boards and councils and committees and doing some philanthropy regarding higher ed, hadn't thought that my wife Stephanie and I could play a role there where we could serve. Now, my alma mater got back in touch and thought that we could. And so that led to us coming, you know, making the decision in October of 2012 to start here at the beginning of 13. And now that we're in 2020, it has been the greatest 7 years of our professional careers to be in a town this friendly, this welcoming, this, they want Jacksonville University to do well. Now to your question, the idea that I think when you come back as an alum, I was reasonably well known as a student athlete here, so there are still some professors when I got here in late 12 and early 13 who I had taken finance and economics from. It was remarkable. You think your life has changed a lot in 32 years, and there they are. I think people, they gave us the requisite honeymoon period to kind of figure it out. They were very kind to me as a leader to kind of make my way. It was a new industry for me to come out of the, you know, Fortune 100 companies into higher education is different. And I think the fact that I went here, maybe they were a bit more patient with me, which I'm grateful for. It has gone incredibly well. I'll tell you, when you're out talking about the university in 2020, it matters in a lot of places that you come back home. And people, they assess just how committed any president is to their university, any faculty member, any athletic director. and the fact that decisions you made in the 70s, you're still making in the 2020s, I think resonates with people, and they've told me that.
I hear that you are known for handing out your cell phone to students. How many take you up on it?
Yeah.
Do you get texts in the middle of the night from folks?
That is an accurate statement about what we do. And we do that during, there's a moment when students are trying to decide where to go to school, where they're going through their junior year, some as late as their senior year. And the class that has just come in August of 19 and the one that's coming in now in August of 20 are stellar. They're from all around the world. Their grades are higher. They're a very well-positioned, sophisticated, smart group. They're highly diverse in every meaning of that word. And I have found over time when we bring them in for orientation, we do 4 orientation sessions near the end of the summer just to help them get acclimated. And we always invite their families. In the first one, I think it was the spring of 13, yeah, I gave out my cell phone number. And in those early days, people sort of chuckled because they thought it wasn't your cell phone number. And then as the years went by, when you'd give out the cell phone number, you'd immediately see the students, the prospective students who just agreed to come to the university, kind of whip out their cell phone, and you'd hear all the ballpoint pens click of the parents. And now in 19 and 20, I think it's become a little bit of the culture. I'll tell you what I think's interesting about it. They don't want to call me. There's no 18, 19, or 20-year-old who wants to talk on the phone with me, and I don't take that personally. But the idea that they have a route to text, exactly what you said, on matters that are important to them, and they fall all over the place. So, for example, it's not unusual when students kind of begin to understand maybe what my background was, which was very heavily corporate and healthcare and financial services and things, that when they get into certain classes, they'll text and they're studying, you know, the capital asset pricing model in the American equity markets, or they're studying what we used to call Obamacare, and they'll text and say, do you have, you know, something you read? But sometimes they just text and say, Mr. President, there's a pothole in parking lot E, do you know? So I don't mind that either. It has been a tether between the student body and the administration. I have a remarkable dean of students, Dr. Christy Gover, who's so talented. And so I don't worry that we won't hear the voice of the student here. The students are, we're in their places, I'm in their places, they're in our places. We sit in the boardroom at the university with 30 different ones of them every single month. And by the end of the year, you've met 300, and then you have them all over to your house, and you do this on a regular basis, and you eat where they eat, and you're available to them. And I think that's what it's become, is they know it is not, many people kind of my circa say, I'm not sure I'd want, you know, 4,000 teenagers to have my cell phone number. It's a blessing because they're comfortable. They don't abuse it. Mm-hmm. I'm so impressed every year when, in the first week of the year, so if we're going to have a few months to August of 2020, in that window of time, I'll hear from a lot of the first year students. They'll text and say, how does this work or that? And they don't even know. They could ask their resident assistant, or I've got an associate dean of students. We've got a head of the Student Solutions Center. We've got an academic advising group. We've got a tutoring center. And you kind of triage that a little bit for them. By the time they're third and fourth year here, the interactions are really gratifying because they're thinking about what they want to do with their careers. We just had one of our terrific young female graduates get a job at Major League Baseball up in New York City, where right across from where I used to work on Park Avenue. We've gotten them over at Google and Amazon and consulting firm. That's when the interaction, if they want to be brief, the interesting thing about it, think further. Today, in 2020, I'm still hearing from students who graduated from here in 14 and 15. So they're 27, 28 years old. They're getting into their career. They want to knock ideas around, or they say, hey, when's the next time you're in Boston? Mm-hmm. That, to me, when you ask, you know, is there any secret sauce to what the good universities can do? It is the relationship. It has to be a family. Jacksonville University is a family. It moves and acts and thinks that way. We use that language. I know many don't, but it works for us. And the idea that they know that if something comes up, they're sitting in a classroom with 15 other students, not 500 other students. So if they're missing in action for a while, or if they got sick, or if they're struggling in some way, we reach out to them. So I think that's part of the ethos of what we believe in. And students self-select. There's probably no more free market for 17, 18, and 19-year-olds than their choice of universities, and there's everything they can imagine out there. So we do think we differentiate ourselves that way.
Quick aside, President Cost, did that secret sauce, was that a carryover from your time in corporate America? Were you as accessible? Was your leadership as accessible? Or has your style kind of pivoted since that time?
What I found is as you went up a large corporation, as I did in a couple of really big corporations, and then you'd start to go across the top of corporations. So you'd rise up Fortune's Most Admired Company in its day, Kodak, in the 80s. Then you'd move over to a huge pharmaceutical company like Bristol-Myers Squibb, and then you'd end up, EVP of Aaron. Then you'd end up at PepsiCo. So once you went up and over, your question is right on the point, because I found that everybody's smart. Everybody's gutsy. Everybody can make a call. Everybody can risk adjust their decisions. Everybody understands how finance works and account. But their leadership is way more than, as many people know, and you're doing this on your series, which I advocate. I think it's very, very helpful and important for Jacksonville to honor its own innovation and leadership and innovation. But the idea that there's no leadership without followership. I mean, this idea that the smartest person in the room, to me, is always the room. Always. You're never the smart. I mean, the degree to which you carry that chip on your shoulder, that you're the smart one and you're the leader, especially as you're going from high up in a large corporation to high up in another large corporation, that's death. No one will follow you. I used to say in my time in the pharmaceutical industry, you can press all the right buttons, but if you look down and the cord is just hanging there, you're not leading anything, even if you're right. So the idea of how we decided what leadership style worked for us. I mean, for me, I found a more open, a slightly less formal. There's lots of terms for it today. I never heard the term servant leader when I was coming up through the organization, but I was the captain of a lot of sports teams. And the degree to which, as captain, you were making it about you, your team didn't care about you. The degree to which you might have been a better player and you're making it about them, I think you could get where you wanted to go. But the idea by the time we got to higher ed, I just found this yearning, this really strong feeling at my alma mater that it wanted to be great. It wanted to be premier, wanted to become preeminent, and that the degree to which it was either a, quote, hidden gem that people didn't know about, or that it hadn't had the opportunity to invest in certain areas, or it hadn't pursued technologies or fields, I leaned very hard into that. And when you listen carefully, you do this for a living, and we have the opportunity to then start to play back to people, it could be this or it could be this. Ultimately, though, you got to make the call, and I'm very comfortable with that over the years. But I do think honing your leadership craft in a large corporation transferred well. I do believe leadership travels. I think if you find a really fine hospital administrator and you find out that they're also involved in their church or the United Way, that never surprises me. I mean, there are people bent to do that sort of thing. And I'm fortunate I'm married to a woman who's Stephanie, who very much believes in community service and the community, whether that means writing a check or serving on a board or being a sounding board or being a mentor to students. Yeah, it's gratifying at the moment. So yes, I think the answer is yes, that it does travel.
Well, the thing that's exciting to me too is the example that you're providing and the fact that you are creating this legacy of what a leader can look like for these students who are graduating, but remaining in touch with you and the influence that you're undoubtedly having on them as they move into a leadership position. I think we can only benefit as a society, because I think we need more people like this.
Yeah, well, you're kind there. I'll tell you where I got. I mean, and it's interesting kind of how the loop closes, because when I was an undergrad here back in 1977, I came down from upstate New York. I played a bunch of sports. I didn't know there was no internet. I mean, students today say, did you get attracted when you went on the website? I said, not in 1977, you didn't. But the idea that the person here who was emerging as a leader was Dr. Fran Kinney. And Dr. Kinney became the president during my time here. She's the first woman president of a university in this region. At the time, Flo Davis, was the chairman of the board. So you had a female in 1979, president of a university, and a female board chair. And when you're 19 years old like I was, that looked perfectly normal. That was the mindset you went into and said, Fran Kinney, who, by the way, in a couple of months is going to be 103 years old and still on a regular, I just saw her over the holidays, obviously, but the idea that Fran and her way of leading, she was everywhere. I would watch her come into event. You'd get invited to things if they were athletic events because you were a head of a team or something, or if you made the dean's list. You'd see the president come in. Always remember this. And President Kinney was easy to find. She always wore like canary yellow or fire engine red, and she had this great head of red hair and still does. And the idea that she would come in and rather than go to the gray-haired gentleman with the three-piece suits, she'd go over and she'd be talking to the people who were like pouring the soft drinks. And and I'd say, what? At the time, you're just it just goes in the back of your mind. And so this idea, and we've talked quite a bit about it, about this servant leadership role, it was extremely well modeled. So you're kind enough to give credit. I don't know what today's students are observing or taking away from their interaction with me or any of the leaders here. We've got tremendous senior leadership team here. But they're picking up something, just like I picked it up from Fran.
Let's revisit. You mentioned the fact that here we are in Jacksonville, which really is known for its health industry. And that's really influenced where JU is focusing its maybe new buildings and that sort of thing. We even hear a little bit of the construction in the background on this audio. Mm-hmm. What is happening here on campus? Can you kind of give us the highlight reel of what's to come in 2020?
Sure. So yeah, it's an exciting time. Anytime you kick off a new decade, you know, when you've been around since the 1930s and you look at kind of where 2020 can take you, we have had a really impressive, I think to a lot of people who are surprised, trajectory of progress here in this window of sort of 12, 13 to 20. So rather than recount the past, let's talk about the future. So here in just the next month or so, we're going to be opening the largest physical building that we've ever opened on the northeast side of campus, which is our new health sciences center. That whole academic health sciences idea matches the profile of the area. So we're close partners with Mayo, we're close partners with Brooks, we're close partners with Florida Blue and Baptist, of course, and Memorial and all those. So you're going to see a physical manifestation of that belief come to life with the building. You're also going to see later here in 2020, by the time we get into the summer, the opening of our new STEAM Center, which will be the place where we co-locate all of the kind of modern artificial intelligence, virtual reality, robotics, all that. That's all going to be in with our engineering. You're going to see that. Seeing some pretty substantial upgrades, what we've been doing to our profile athletically. We play 19 Division I sports at this university. It's about 450 undergraduates. So if 450 of your 3,000 undergraduates, you know, roughly one out of seven who walk this campus are Division I athletes, that gives us a very strong sense of, I think, responsibility. These young men and women carry themselves very well. They manage their time well. We have almost 600 members of the military on this campus, either current or retired, faculty, staff, or students. So when you've got that number of athletic and military young men and women on your campus, it helps set a culture. It's a culture we're really proud of. So if you were to come on this campus somewhere between January and May of this coming year, a lot of the newer and more exciting programming, how we're running the arts through a number of things we do is very exciting. The buildings will be opening up. The programming will be being put together. We're unleashing quite a bit of new technology, which I'm excited about in the classroom. So I think as people come around here, they often I do a lot of tours myself. I have a little golf cart, and we run people around, and I hope you'll consider it, or Craig or others. But this idea that when we move them around this campus and we take them into the buildings where they see things, they didn't know that we had a simulation center here that looks exactly like a hospital. They didn't know you can essentially sit down over in the Davis College of Business and our aviation group, and you know, I can press a button and you can take off out of O'Hare in Chicago, and I can press another button and it's nighttime and it's raining and we'll have you land into LAX. And that idea that there's new and different and exciting technologies, I think is people come around and inevitably, if they don't have a familiarity with the university, they say the exact same thing. Every single time, like clockwork, when we start to get out of the cart and go back to my office, they all say the same thing. I had no idea.
Right.
And that's okay. That I had no idea kind of fits with your earlier thinking about the hidden gem nature of the university. So I think there's not going to be any longer. If you and I are having this conversation in September of 2020 and we're still a hidden gem, that's on us.
You know, I wonder too, excuse me, President Cost, if your relationships that you mentioned you have with some of the big employers and the big leaders in the city, including Baptist Health, if maybe your relationships with them might also help promote what you do and what JU is capable of. And I have a case in point. I remember reading that when the Ebola crisis first came on the scene as a global scare, there was real concern locally about how would our local health system treat an Ebola victim. And they came to you. They came to JU and asked through your simulation or whatever the program was at the time, help us figure this out. And you did. Right. Can you maybe give us a little bit, you know, give us a little bit of that backstory? And then what's your thought on that? Do you think your business partners are really here to really help position the real world solutions that JU is helping to provide?
Yeah, no, that's a great example. So let me give you a quick 30 seconds on that story and then kind of how it explodes into what we really believe. So when something like that happens, whether it was flesh-eating bacteria and the Fish and Wildlife folks want you to do it or the riverkeeper does, this case was pretty rich because it was one of those cases where a university like ours ought to be, when you're, quote, private or independent, we obviously turn toward Tallahassee less than many, so we're able to make decisions that also has funding implications. And there's great state universities around here. We love them all. We partner with them all. But the idea in this case was that a potential health scare, that the network of those doing healthcare provision, so remember, we're close partners with, as we said, with Baptist and Mayo and others. So they came and they were looking for an intellectual partner. Sort of, they weren't exactly, you know, how can we get our arms around this idea? And how might we, in this case, Baptist, who's been our partner for 35 years, helped us launch our nursing program, which is great, came to us and they wanted to enact in a very similar way that whenever you hear about people doing training for an active assailant on campus, you hear that kind of training. And we get the arts folks involved in that. I mean, they literally do makeup and they're actors and they can pretty much approximate what it's like if someone were to breach your campus security, which fortunately has never happened here. But in the case of Ebola, yeah, they came to us and they wanted us. We had our students actually study up on what are the symptoms of Ebola, and then we had them physically made up to look like those who were suffering from Ebola, and then we moved them from the art side of campus to the healthcare side of campus, and we put them in our simulation center on the second floor of the Brooks Building, and the Baptist nurses were able to then train on what kind of gear did they have to wear to deal with Ebola victims who were presenting in a certain way. They physically looked like exactly what Ebola victims that we were familiar with outside the country would look like. And that sort of reality, well, look, it's exciting when a university can help corporate partners, corporate, whether they're hospitals or whether they're web.com or whether it's CSX or whether it's Avality or whomever. That idea, to your question, the larger question is there a role there for the university, and you know, how does it kind of come to be? So more and more and more we're having earlier and earlier conversations with the corporations in the greater Jacksonville area about the role an educational institution can play, whether it's research or writing white papers or doing proprietary things or getting grant, whatever it is. And I think Jacksonville, possibly, unlike Charlotte that got used to it, Nashville that got used to it, Philadelphia got used to it, New York City got used to it, those cities, when I was in large corporate America, when especially in Washington, D.C., with, say, Georgetown or New York City with NYU and Columbia, Philadelphia with Penn, it was natural that you would say, in the business side, we're going to do blank, we're thinking about this, let's see what's going on there. Let's go over to Wharton and see if they're doing this, if they're going to want to do this with us. And I think Jacksonville, to its great credit, is getting smarter and smarter on the role that schools like ours can play. And Jacksonville University, we tell them it's open for business. We love those conversations. I mean, in healthcare alone, we've created over 400 partnerships in the last few years. The idea where it was last year in 19, we opened the simulation center down near Brooks Rehab. We took over another building and that we rehabbed it. If you go into that building now over near Brooks Rehabilitation, it's the Jacksonville University Healthcare Simulation Center, you'd swear you're walking into a hospital. And everything about that was such that all of the great hospitals in this region, in this healthcare-rich region, destination region, can now train their staff, whether it's nurses or others, techs. So, you know, every Wednesday here on the Jacksonville University campus, you'll see nurses from around the region training their recent graduates, many from here, thank goodness. They're back training in the latest state of the art of how things are done, let's just pick one, at Baptist or Mayo, and we're teaching it over here. So what does that do? That tightens our connection with those folks. There's so many examples now where the thinking that's been going on, whether it's autonomous vehicles in Jacksonville between what's going on at JTA or what's going on at Elite Parking, and we're a partner in those. What's going on down at the district? You know, we're the exclusive education partner of the district because the district's trying to prove, and we'll help them if we can, to show that if you live a healthy lifestyle, whether you're 70 or 27, that you can live a kind of multi-generational lifestyle in a healthy way. And we said, that's an interesting marketing pitch, but you'd actually need to run a placebo-controlled trial to prove that, and we know how to do that. So to the credit of those organizing around the district and the city of Jacksonville, we're now doing that work. So as you start to insert into the thinking of a good and growing city like Jacksonville, that the higher educational component can accelerate what they're doing. I think that's why folks like me are asked to participate in the Jacksonville Chamber, the Jacks USA Partnership, or the Civic Council, or various boards. It's because I think people are hungry for the intellectual content that a good university can provide.
So, President Kosk, you've mentioned the importance and the emphasis that JU is putting on that meshing of the disciplines. STEAM is a real thing. You're building, you're physically co-locating your science, technology, arts, engineering, math functions here on campus. Are you seeing that thinking, that philosophy, spill over into business? So, for example, with the Simulation Center, are you helping to kind of maybe break down those silos that healthcare can tend to operate in by emphasizing that, you know, that interdisciplinary thinking?
So, you know, over the holidays, reread the book Range by Daniel Epstein. If you take into account, at least my own personal experience, 32 years in corporate America, we were full of super experts, unbelievable subject matter expertise that could go a mile deep. And those who ended up in the leadership positions tended to be what we used to call the multidimensional athlete. I mean, I have a finance and economics background, but I ran marketing departments, and you can speak a few foreign languages, and you get, and people want to go with you and the management team as to where they want to go. So we absolutely brought that thought. We call it silo busting. Sometimes if I get animated, I say we got to burn that silo to the ground. But, you know, organizations tend to build silos to the moon, and they tend to be very hard to break down. And we kind of operate with this kind of cross-functional, diagonal slice approach to things. And we're blessed due to our relative size and a really talented senior management team, you can bring together the head of the arts and the head of athletics and the head of the faculty and get to a solution in a few days. And that's, I'm sure, much more difficult at larger universities or universities that see themselves differently. But we have gone that, and you kind of begin to pull threads through. We believe in the classic liberal arts and sciences mode. People ought to be able to communicate well. We really believe in not just writing, but we believe in public speaking. I've told people many times, you listen to someone speak and you're going to equate that with their ability to lead and their intelligence. That may be right, that may be wrong, but you're doing yourself a disservice if you say, I'm smart and I don't want to get up in front of people. We don't. We force that to happen. And it's been part of my own background. I think leadership moves in that way. I've said many times, you know, go look at, you know, the old videotapes of certain elected officials, and then, you know, play them against, how did you feel when you first saw Barack Obama speak? Or does anybody remember what it was like to see Jesse Jackson speak in his era, or Mario Cuomo? And how did we feel when those people spoke? So the idea of a couple of different things. One, I think if they're going to be in the field of business, they need to have some agility around finance and economics and statistics and accounting. They don't have to be majors in that, so we pull that through. I love the idea of the critical thinking skills, the communication skills, basic economics, the idea that you can pull the arts. A really talented professor here at the university challenged me when I was an undergrad. I was getting very good marks. I thought I knew what I wanted to do. It worked out. I got into business. And she said, you're going to want to be much smarter in the arts. She gave me a book on Leonardo da Vinci, I mean, the classic scientist, artist. And I started taking a handful of arts courses. And I was not going to be an artist, but I knew my Manet from my Monet by the time I graduated from here. And it's remarkable how that has played through. I mean, the arts sensibilities that we've now been able to pull the string through the university, plus my wife and I have just developed over time a real appreciation. I don't know if you could fully call us patrons of the arts, but what here on this campus, in any given day, you can have an amazing orchestral performance and then jazz, and then you can be opening a new museum exhibition, and that it's just unbelievable range. And that's why I like the idea where you were going, that I think the innovative future is going to be around, you can look at some of the great inventors, whether it's Da Vinci or come forward to like Jobs, they had unusual multidimensional backgrounds. There will always be Wall Street Journal ran a piece not too long ago in December of last year where they talked about the percentage of CEOs in the Fortune 500 with a general liberal arts and sciences background. You know, it's north of 70%. So that's just one way. I think many of us think the people who get ahead in certain lines of work, they're either engineers or they're attorneys or they're very hardwired to something. I like the idea of a more agile, well-rounded student, and that's who we tend to attract, and we try to feed that once they get here.
Do you have any challenge with the students who really communication is just through text? I know this generation are even, like you said, they're not going to phone call you. They're really not used to even talking publicly. So is that a hurdle that you have to clear with this group? Or are you, again, attracting a different kind of student that's looking for that opportunity to brush up on their speaking skills?
No, that's a really hot subject. So I'd be remiss if I don't mention another book. There's a book called iGen by Dr. Jean Twenge, of PhD from San Diego State, which is a compilation of data dating back 50 years on the behavior of 15 to 25-year-olds, roughly. But iGen, the term that's coined, because that's what I want to talk with you about, because you just brought it up, are those in this country born after 1995. So it's not millennials or Gen X or Y or Z or next gen, et cetera. So born after 1995, it's 2020. So what is it we're dealing with here? Those are high school age to college age students. And what you described is 100% true. There's never been a time they've had more access to more information in the palm of their hand, elegant design, incredible speeds, unlimited power. And what's in this book that, you know, maybe folks listening to this would think about is the capturing of 11 million bits of data over 50 years of what has this cell phone, this iPad, these technologies, what has it done to the way we think, and what has it done to the way we interact with each other? We know it's kind of an old joke that I can build a library and they'll come in and they'll sit, if there's a Starbucks there, they'll sit right next to each other with their earpieces in and they'll be very happy. And Epstein calls it in range parallel trenches. The idea that we're each able to go deeper and deeper and deeper into our subject, and occasionally we poke our head up and look over a neck and say, ooh, that would be interesting, and which is a more Da Vinci-like way of approaching things. So it is a challenge. I don't know any university that recruits its way around the modern way of communicating. There's lots of organizations that folks like me belong to, we have similar job titles, and you talk about what it's like. There's a massive uptick in their use of handheld technology to apply to universities. And a lot of people listening to this may remember what it was like to apply to a university. I mean, more than half are doing it entirely on their cell phone. It's changing how well they write, for sure. They're used to abbreviations. They're also used to occasionally voice technology. For years, people have been saying it's going to rewire brains, and they idea of watching a 60-year-old person with a problem, with a challenge, trying to figure out how old someone is or does that product still available, we will tend to go into the Googlification of the economy, and we'll look at it like we used to use an encyclopedia. We'll put in a name and we'll read all about it. A student will put in, how old is Bernie Sanders? And the thing will say 79. And so the idea of the short-circuiting of how we go about things, the way people used to discover as they learned, and now they're learning for very specifics, no question about it. And the idea of these devices that you're referencing, you have choices. You can either, as they're doing in some high schools in California, taking them from students at the beginning of the day, putting them in a Kevlar pouch, locking it, giving the pouch to the student, and say you can have it at the end of the day. That's hard in a college campus because people won't come here if you take their phones from them. Or you can say, well, I guess that's just the way it's going to be. It's going to be a distraction. Or you can teach through it, with it, as your partner. And that's what we're spending a lot of time on. The really good universities are talking about, the old way of doing it, 10 years ago was, to turn the classroom around, to flip the classroom, do all these things outside the classroom. Then in other words, we'll post all this really interesting content for you, whether it's podcasts or whether it's videos or via whatever. And then when you come into the classroom, we'll debate it and discuss it. And so the amplification of the learning will take place in the classroom. We all do that. We built studios here, so we know how to do that. That's great. It's kind of, how do you go beyond that? How do we, if they're going to spend this amount of time on their devices, which right now is running north of 9 hours a day, amazing data come out of this. The number of times that 18-year-olds interact with their parents on a daily basis is more than six. And folks like me who went to school in the 70s, I didn't talk to my parents six times a semester. Who had the money to make the long distance phone call? So that idea of capturing, embracing, amplifying the use of technology is a big push. The better schools are doing it well. I like where we're going with it, but there's no question it's a challenge because they've learned to write, speak, interact with each other in a fundamentally different way than even pre-2007 when the iPhone came out.
You know, President Cost, I think that what you're learning here on campus would be very applicable to today's workplace where, you know, obviously we have an aging workforce that's going to be moving, you know, into, you know, retirement and an influx of the younger worker. Mm-hmm. And we're still trying to figure out how do you communicate? How do you make that connection with the younger employee? So I hope that JU puts its learnings out, you know, in a consumable way for those business leaders that are here.
Yeah, no, that's great. You're right. I mean, let me focus on one real quick. Clarity. I mean, prioritization is a struggle for young people because they're inundated. I don't know about you, but it's not an unusual day for me to get hundreds of emails. So it's the old Yogi Berra, you know, that restaurant's so crowded, nobody goes there anymore. I mean, that idea that you can't efficiently expect to communicate well to 18 to 24-year-olds if you say, I posted it. That's not good enough. I don't think it's fair to ask the people of Jacksonville. If they want to find out what's going on about Jacksonville University, go to www.ju.edu. I mean, yeah, you're putting a burden on them. So it's just an anecdote. We talk to our students all the time. Every year, we talk to our students about how do you want us to communicate with you? Because things are going on. I reserve blast text for emergencies. So if something's happening on our campus, if a hurricane has changed, if someone's come onto campus, I will blast text directly from the press. It's the only time I do it. I don't say, hey, come to the big baseball game against the University of Florida. I mean, that's not how because blast text is a shocking intervention with a student body. But when we ask them how they like to be communicated with on a regular basis, frequently they will say face-to-face. And we talk about that with them. And you say, okay, we have the ability to text you. We can post things. We can do podcasts. We can do webcasts. We can do all these things. And they say, yeah, there's so much of that that if you just have somebody come in, either the residence hall or the dining hall, and just like hand us something, and you think, well, you've just gone back in time, but what does it do? It breaks through the clutter. Mm. The idea that these devices are so part of them. They're an addendum. I mean, the data on what happens if a teenager in America can't find their phone for 10 seconds. I mean, the physical response is akin to a true panic attack. I mean, everything, the pupil dilation, the sweat. I mean, so this idea of how do universities become relevant in the lifestyle? You can't rail against their lifestyle. You can't carve it, or you can't try to overly shape it. They're coming to us smarter than they ever were, more global than they ever were, better prepared to succeed if we can light their fire, their work ethic fire. And it's not wise, I don't believe, for good private universities like ours that are getting better to try to bend and shape. Don't learn this way. You must learn that way. That's how we learn. We were told, don't look out the window, write it in a number two pencil. And today, since you're talking all about innovation, it's who can innovate around the innovations that are around us. So as we're watching where I think Google's trying to go next with the use to bring back glass as a real player, so that it's possible that in the next X number of years, you and I aren't carrying as many things as we are. Perhaps we're wearing things differently and getting information. We have to anticipate that. Because at any given time, sitting here in 2020, we've got to anticipate what is going to be the relevant things people are going to want to learn who are 13 and 14 years old today. And that's where you can have conversations with students today. And you can open their eyes, whether they have siblings or cousins or what. And obviously, we do tons of proprietary research. But you're always looking around the corner, over the hill, if you're going to be a relevant university.
I have another question for you. You have a student body that is from each of the 50 states and from many, did you say 50?
Yep.
Different countries. What is it that they find when they come to Jacksonville? How do we, let's maybe point the lens here on our city. You've made an extraordinary case for JU being this leading edge innovator in academia and making it relevant to industry and arts and such. Is Jacksonville where it needs to be, or where can we grow? Where can we become more innovative and really be a home that people want to reside in? They want to stay once they graduate from a place like JU.
So you're right. In our time, we've graduated from students from all 50 states and over 100 countries around the world. That really is the role a university like this one can play. The state university's got its charter, and the HBCUs have its charter, and the community colleges have its charter, and the private universities have its. In the great cities around America, that's what you see, and you see that here. So I think the positioning of higher education assets is appropriate. Now to your question. The idea that when you bring in this high a percentage of those for whom Northeast Florida culture is different than what they're used to. It's not just the volleyball player from Brazil or the golfer from Mexico. Sometimes, you know, it's the young person who wanted to come here from Seattle or San Diego, and they come and they encounter or they begin to see Jacksonville, which is, I mean, I'm a Northeasterner, born and raised in upstate New York, lived my whole life in Philadelphia, Washington, and New York. And the idea that Jacksonville, in many ways, isn't particularly southern to many when they're thinking of, you know, the deep south. It may be more southern north of here, you know, as you get into Georgia. But your question is a good one. So what we do when we first bring them in is we again, back to this idea of finding the experiences they want to have, we'll put them in water taxis and we'll move them over to arts markets. So when One Spark was a player, our students loved it. I mean, that to them, the idea to physically move around and see innovation around them, set aside whether or not that was a sustainable economic model, but as an exciting thing for young people to see, that was great. So agreements we work out with the Comer, or agreements we work out with hospitals, or this idea of physically moving them around, I think that they understand concepts like accelerators and incubators. And frankly, over the course of the last few years, we've privatized that and brought it onto campus. Things that they may want to do to play around with the next generation of an autonomous vehicle that's moving around a campus, which we'll have on this campus this year, partnering with JTA and Nat Ford and what they're doing, partly partnering with Elite Parking and Dane and what they're doing. And I think Jacksonville has a huge upside opportunity to spark the innovative interests of 18 to 24-year-olds. They come here, they fall in love with the university, then they understand what Arlington is, then they understand what Jacksonville is, then they understand whether it's professional sports or entertainment. And at the moment, the reason your question has such relevance is at the moment, we have enough juice and game where we can bring a lot of that here ourselves. We can bring Ken Burns onto campus. We brought Dr. Mandela onto campus here last year. I mean, we're bringing business leaders, and we're bringing elected leaders, and we're bringing world-class performances here. And part of the flip side of your question is our ability, and we're working out now, to kind of open ourselves up to the community and to say, we hope you'll come and partake, whether it's Gianrico Ferrugia, the CEO of the Mayo Clinic, coming onto campus, or Indra Nui, the CEO of PepsiCo, coming onto campus. I'm excited, I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic. It's going to be a lot of hard work. Jacksonville is blessed with lots of things. It's geographic diversity, it's expansion. People can get excited about Nocatee or the district or downtown or Lot J or San Marco or Riverside or Jacksonville University. And so it's hard to, you know, the old line was you can't be a suburb to nowhere. But the idea that having a centralized space, and many of us are helping the really good work going on in downtown with the DIA and others, we've got a ways to go. But I think there's a lot of upside there. You can't set aside how much people love being in this kind of weather, in a more youthful orientation. I think the stance is more innovation oriented. And I think you see that. It's interesting the number of publications that pick Jacksonville as a place where this sort of thing can occur. Now it has to occur.
And I'm going to add to, you know, the weather and the other attributes you've mentioned, President Cost, that friendliness, that feeling that you got when you were first welcomed here as president, but hopefully also found in local business leaders. We've heard from a lot of our other Innovate Jacks guests that when they really wanted to propel forward in their career, how willing people were to help them get there. Yeah. And I think that that's something that's really unique to our city. Would you agree?
I would. And I think as you talk to sometimes folks who focus on innovation, talk to those of us in certain positions, and we have come from outside Jacksonville. So whether it's Pat Garrity or Nat Ford or Amari or Adam over at Comer, I mean, all incredibly talented, innovative people, all of whom came from outside Jacksonville. And so we have a similar experience. My experience has been really extraordinary. I mean, we've lived in lots of different cities. Maybe if I came here from still in my days at PepsiCo, I'd have just been one more PepsiCo guy. But I mean, people want the university to do well. It's a flat city, and that you can move north and south it to get, I mean, there are other cities I've been in where to get to somebody with economic development powers or the mayor's office or reach someone at a large university or a big corporation, you know, no chance. These days in this town, you can do that fairly seamlessly. And I mean this, constructively. The idea of being optimistic. You know, we talk to our students all the time about persistence and optimism and respect and teamwork. And I've never, and that's after 40 years out in the world. Persistence, optimism, respect, and teamwork. If you can embrace those, you don't have to rank them as highly as I do, but this idea that a town like this one, I can remember Stephanie and I going into a grocery store. We'd been here not a month, and it was a classic Northeasterner having an experience in Jacksonville. And everybody, we still laugh about it, smiling, waving, people talking to us, to the point where, like, she was covering her purse. Like, is there something? I mean, if this happened to you in New York, I mean, it would be a very unusual day. So, I mean, I hope people celebrate that about Jacksonville, because it's blessed.
I agree there. Yeah. All right, so let's close this out. President Cost, I would love to hear from you. What's your vision for JU in the next 5 to 10 years? And then wrap into that vision Arlington, and then wrap into it Jacksonville.
Wow. And you want to do that in 1 minute. All right, here we go.
1 minute.
Here we go. All right, so it's good because they're nesting dolls, that question, right? So the idea that Jacksonville University, between now and the end of this brand new decade, you'll see it flexing its muscles economically in the Arlington area, and we'll talk about that. The idea that we're going to probably become a slightly larger university. You know, when I went here, it was 1,400 students. When I came back to serve in late 12 and early 13, it was about 3,500 students. Today, it's about 4,300 students. You're getting into a range now where, you know, 4,500 to 5,000 students is a good, what the world might call mid-major. Preeminence is the goal. We're focused in what we can do. A school like ours should not be trying to pursue 150 majors for students. That's not what we do. We have 70 different fields of study, but it's going to harken back to the areas that we were talking about earlier, healthcare, business, the arts, and the arts and sciences. We believe in Arlington. We're not leaving Arlington. We're doubling down. We're investing. So let me ping over to that. The concept here would be a collegiate village around the university. I think you've seen it done really well in Winston-Salem at Wake Forest, really well in New Haven around Yale. I think Penn did a beautiful job with it in their portion of Center City, Philadelphia. You can be a catalyst here, and we want to be a helpful catalyst. We're not trying to bend anybody to our will, but we're a multi-hundred-million-dollar economic engine sitting in Arlington. We're building tens of millions of dollars worth of hard assets here. We're bringing in remarkable young people and their families from all around the world. I mean, I believe we have a responsibility and an obligation to Arlington to have the whole area, that the University and Merrill Corridor for sure, and you see a lot of steps we're taking on that, everything from zoning overlays and CRAs and TIF funding, and you'll see more of that. So I think you're going to see the kind of, we're calling it Renew Arlington. Some people call it Revitalize. Some people call it Renaissance. When I was here as a young student athlete, I'll tell you, Arlington was beautiful. It was one of the beautiful, most beautiful places I've ever seen. I ran these streets as a pitcher on the baseball team. And obviously, Arlington's changed since I graduated, and we're looking to help it get where it wants to go. Now to Jacksonville. Jacksonville, I think, is getting closer to making some decisions. I'm a big believer in the unique role we play in the world of healthcare. I like Jacksonville, Florida, as a healthcare hub. I think you've got one of the few places in the entire world with a world-class Mayo Clinic and MD Anderson Cancer Center. You've got schools like ours that are major players now in healthcare education, administration, preparation. So there's that. I think Jacksonville is going to make its way. It has to. This next decade is the decade where it has to put its foot down. The clarity that a Nashville has had, a Raleigh-Durham has had, a Charlotte's had, those kind of cities, we're on our way there. So I think it's a very exciting time, and our students are excited, and so are all of us.
President Cost, this has been such a pleasure learning from you, and just excited to see, again, the catalyst that you're going to be in this city and Florida and beyond. You're well on your way.
Thanks, Kate, and thanks to Forcure for doing this. I think it's great.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Innovate Jax. For show notes and a list of all our episodes, go to Forcura.com/InnovateJax. Know a Jacksonville changemaker who'd make a great podcast guest? We want to hear from you. Message us at InnovateJax@Forcura.com. Thanks for listening.